Well, now the growing friction over China's treatment of Uyghurs, the Muslim minority living in Xinjiang. Human rights groups say that up to a million people have been detained in what China calls re-education camps in the province and are subject to forced labour. Several countries, including the UK, United States and Canada, have accused China of committing genocide. China's ambassador has warned New Zealand about interfering in its internal matters, including the Uyghur question and the situation in Hong Kong. Last week, the Chinese embassy were hosted a video call for media in which it defended China's human rights record. Meanwhile, the ACT Party will ask Parliament to debate a motion declaring China's oppression of the minority an act of genocide. Dr. David Brophy is Senior Lecturer in Modern Chinese History at the University of Sydney. He specialises in the social and political history of China's northwest, particularly the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region. David, welcome to 9 to Noon. Thanks very much.
Morning, Catherine. Good to be with you.
Just what is the situation there as best it can be established?
Well, I think you could sum up the situation there as a mass coercive social transformation campaign. And the basic outlines of this are quite apparent from the from government documents and from testimony of people who have been able to leave Xinjiang in the last couple of years. You have a very intense ideological climate there at the moment, along lines of religion, nationality. There's been a lot of extrajudicial detention. We're also seeing a lot of people being put through the criminal justice system and ending up with extremely severe sentences for really what looked like quite trivial offences. And then there's also a campaign to transform the political economy of this region, which you can think of in a sense as pushing or pulling people out of the traditional social environments in the villages and moving people into factory employment that the Chinese state regards as politically desirable, leaving aside its economic effects, as say bringing people into proximity with mainstream Chinese culture environments where they're going to learn to speak Chinese and become, in the party's eyes, you know, loyal, productive Chinese citizens. It's been a very traumatic experience for many people in that region for the last 3 to 4 years.
You talk about establishing things from documents. How difficult has it been for human rights groups or for journalists to in recent years to spend time there and to gather information?
Well, that's been practically impossible. And this is one of the key obstacles in the discussion at the moment, that there really is no opportunity to do any kind of on the ground investigation or reporting. Most of what we're discussing is on the basis of information that's been acquired, open access material that the government itself is putting out, or scholars in China or other sources putting out within China that are describing what's going on. Then you have a bit of work that's been done on the basis of satellite imagery, trying to identify particular locations as re-education camps and so on. And then you have the testimony of ex-detainees, people who have had some contact with this campaign, or people who've been able to come out. So there's a variety of different types of evidence, and it can be quite difficult when we start to debate, say, precise figures for the number of people who've been through this extrajudicial re-education process. But as I say, the basic outlines, I think, are can be established. The debate then centres on how you actually characterise and the type of language that you use to describe the situation.
Right. Of the diaspora, what are we seeing of people in Australia and New Zealand, countries like this? What has been happening and has been able to be established as happening to them, even when they have left the country and settled elsewhere? What kinds of things are happening that have been established and that are concerning?
Well, one of the first things that actually gave us a signal of a shift in the political climate was the fact that people all of a sudden were cutting off contact with their relatives outside China. Those who have been able to maintain contact have, at a sort of an individual personal level, been able to describe the experiences of family members who've been you know, taken away and detained. And in some cases, more recently, people have actually been coming out of these re-education camps and returning home. And so it's possible to in some cases, talk to people about the very personal impact that this has had on their families. In other cases, you have people who are still unable to establish the whereabouts or the fate of their family members and are left to speculate whether or not they're still in these re-education processes or if they've been handed some more severe jail sentence. So these are the types of experiences that I think are, you know, immediately palpable as soon as you come into contact with this community. But, you know, we are, of course, talking about people who are now coming to terms with the fact that they may never themselves be able to ever return to Xinjiang. So their picture of the situation is obviously often, you know, at the same distance as we find ourselves in.
What is the history? Let's begin with the geography of this region and why it is of such... why it has attracted such attention from the party and particularly recently. What is its geographical and other significance?
Well, I mean, Xinjiang constitutes about a sixth of the entire territory of China. It's this large northwestern region that was only came to be ruled from Beijing from the 18th century onwards, and that was a process of military conquest. And the control of the region has been relatively tenuous at certain points in time. In the first half of the 20th century, there was very little central government influence on the region. It's a relatively sparsely populated territory. It's only about 24 million people, but it is reasonably resource rich. It's very strategic. It borders on eight different countries. So certainly in terms of thinking of China's outward economic expansion and initiatives such as the Belt and Road heading into Central Asia, it's very important from the state's point of view that this be a stable hub for that kind of economic activity. There's been, for decades now, there has been sporadic instances of conflict. The party has, found it quite difficult to secure the support of the sections of the Uyghur population. We've seen opposition in instances like the 2009 riots in the capital city of Urumqi, which were an episode that really put this place on the international map in terms of discussion of issues of majority-minority relations. Previously, a lot of the focus had been on Tibet. Since then, the turn that we're looking at now was, I think, occasioned by a series of violent incidents in 2013, 2014 that seemed to have really spooked the party, convinced the party that they weren't doing enough to prosecute their counter-terrorism campaign, and that a much wider scope of that campaign was necessary. And that's really what has been the main justification for this very wide-ranging policy of preemptively detaining people and putting them through this ideological re-education. It fits in with a wider global discourse of counter-terrorism, which centers on this idea of preemptively situating Muslim populations along a pathway to radicalization. And that's a kind of policing practice that's been very damaging to Muslim populations all around the world. But China is a particularly extreme case at the moment of applying that across an entire minority group.
I think it was post September 11, 2001, that China began negotiating with the US to get what was regarded as a small-scale conflict in the region as recognised as part of the war on terror, right? So this is to your point of identifying and labelling and formalising what might be seen as a problem, inverted commas. But at what point did the campaign really pick up? Because that's, 20 years ago now.
Sure.
And at what point did what is the process that is happening there really pick up speed and begin to get international attention?
Well, there was a shift in the terminology in around 2014. There was some conferences on Xinjiang work among the party. This new slogan of a people's war on terror came out. The sitting party secretary at the time was replaced in 2016 with a new official who was sent from Tibet, and he clearly had a mandate for this new suite of policies. And so 2016 onwards, we started to hear about new kinds of policing practices that were being introduced. We started to hear reports of, you know, increased surveillance around the cities of Xinjiang. I myself went to the region in 2017, was able to see some of the visible effects of these new policies. Many more checkpoints on the streets, a lot more armed police, clearly a lot more surveillance, people being stopped on the streets, their telephones being checked for the mandatory government spyware and so on. I saw things like that. The news about the re-education camps had yet to break, so I wasn't really on the lookout for anything like that. But it was really obvious to me that there'd been a significant shift in the political climate. And so that was really the starting point. It was 2017. And then I think we can say that the high point of the detention in this re-education camps has probably passed by now. So we are starting to hear about people being released. It seems that terms of 2 years detention in this system has been fairly standard, but the campaign is now shifting into different phases. As I mentioned, there's a lot of people receiving very very harsh jail sentences, and a heightened emphasis on this the labor processes that people are being drawn into as well, which we could talk about. So
is this, well, this is the forced labor, is this being understood as a drive for assimilation? The word genocide is a very strong one. How do you describe, I guess, what the party's motivation is here? Does it want assimilation? Does it want a cultural and other assimilation of a people who are culturally different living in an autonomous region? Is that what the driver is?
Yes. I mean, I think they want ideological compliance. There's clearly a very strong assimilationist drive to this campaign. And I think that that has always been the ambition of the party in relation to a place like Xinjiang, that there gradually would be assimilation towards the norms of mainstream Chinese culture. And I think that there's been a sort of acceptance on the part of the party in the last decade or so that was not the direction of things that people were moving in. That from their point of view, there was still too much, not even dissent, just sort of disinterest on the part of the Uyghurs in the mainstream nation-building narratives that the party was promoting. And that was a situation that created a space for hardliners in this policy space to move in and say that we need to be much more forceful, much more coercive. We need to solve this problem once and for all. So I think the party's really sort of run out of patience with its own policies, really, and has been unable to come up with any alternative, really, other than to put people through these processes that will probably, unfortunately, linger as a warning to anyone in Xinjiang from now on, you know, not to step out of line. And that the hope is ultimately it may take some time, it may take a generation, but the party is patient and they're willing to wait to remake this population as a, you know, into a group that, you know, is much more identifies with the symbols and the mission of the party state, and is you know the space for any advocacy on the basis of a distinctive Uyghur nation or distinctive Uyghur identity is essentially removed.
Including faith and religion, of course. What of the international response of China on this subject? Of course, this all comes at a time of a clear expansion and some would describe as aggression by the Chinese leadership on any number of fronts, whether you're talking about the South China Sea, whether you are talking about the president changing the term limits. There's this the Belt and Road on the economic front. There's this real drive for China to assume its what it believes to be its due place and power in the world. When it comes to responses to this particular issue, both governments talking to China or in some cases imposing sanctions and then what China is saying back, how do you read this in the context of relations in the last couple of decades with our countries, with New Zealand and Australia? Again, is it a much more aggressive pushback?
Well, we're starting to see things that we haven't really seen so much in the past. So that is to say, you know, for example, China has long demanded that foreign countries just simply butt out of China's internal affairs. It seems that they might have begun to give up hope that they ever will, and they're starting to actually make more public criticism, say, for example, of Australian human rights abuses. This is something that they haven't really done in the past, and that's obviously consistent with the sort of tit-for-tat antagonism that certainly Australia has ended up engaged in with China. You know, China clearly, its discourse internally around its policies in Xinjiang is really quite cosmopolitan. Just to go back to the earlier point, it does very much see itself as assimilating, learning from the lessons of the global war on terror, in some ways improving on the type of de-radicalization programs that have been implemented in parts of Europe and so on. And you know, I'm personally very critical of all of those kinds of programs, but from the official Chinese point of view, these are models of counterterrorism. And so that ends them up in a position where they, you know, they feel that the problem for them is not the policies, but you know, their inability to get their message across. And so that's why, you know, we do see, you know, diplomatic missions engaging in these sort of public exercises to try to shift the narrative. Not very successfully, I don't think. But this is, you know, this is clearly the way that China intends to respond to this situation. Now, going back a few years, there was a point at the start where they basically denied the existence of any of these policies, but that flipped quite quickly. And China now, the Chinese state media is engaged in this, you know, ongoing conversation with the Western media on these issues. And you often see it responding directly to specific stories that have arisen outside China. And that could be read as a certain defensiveness, but it could also be read as a certain confidence. They're willing to air these issues, certainly before the Chinese public, and engage in this kind of back and forth, and it is quite.
We're talking about a propagandist media and a propagandist state.
Indeed.
Let's be blunt about it. So how believable are some of these briefings? They've just had some for journalists here in New Zealand, of course, have you been to similar briefings in Australia? What are you presenting?
No, I was actually invited to the briefing in Australia, but I didn't think it was the kind of exercise that I wanted to personally dignify by attending, because I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, these are standard propaganda presentations. I've seen a little bit of the video that they were being presented with, and it was sort of the typical kind of happy singing and dancing ethnic minorities fare that you're likely to be fed with in these kinds of situations. You have then personal testimony from people who are, it's very difficult to say exactly how they've ended up in that position to testify about their situations, or, you know, what sort of pressure might have been applied to them. So no, I don't think that These performances have been particularly persuasive. They are going through the motions, and there's clearly been instructions that this needs to be done. And I
David,
think,
do
you know, in
journalists and academics come under pressure, by the way? Your parliament had an inquiry into just this matter. Do journalists and or academics come under pressure over what they say, do and write? Pressure, or shall we say interest?
Well, I can't really speak for journalists. I've never felt any pressure from any direction as to what I say on this issue. I mean, obviously, if you are a citizen of the PRC, or you're, you know, a former citizen and have family in the PRC, then there's all sorts of pressure that can be applied to you. But no, I don't feel, and I'm it's difficult for me to speak, you know, on behalf of anyone but myself, but I know that, you know, you engage in this debate and you're likely to cop, you know, various sorts of abuse on social media and so on. But in terms of any kind of pressure from state actors or anything like that, I haven't experienced anything like that myself. And I'm struggling to think of instances of people who have. Now, of course, people have to weigh up the possibility. If you speak out on this issue, it may be difficult for you to one day go back to China. That's certainly a consideration.
Okay, thank you so much.
That's
Dr.
not,
thank
yeah.
you. Dr. David Brophy, Senior Lecturer in Modern Chinese History at the University of Sydney.